This is Law and Disorder. This September saw the death of Chief Justice Rehnquist, and it brought to mind, really, the 10th anniversary of another really well-known progressive lawyer, movement lawyer, Bill Kunstler, who died 10 years ago this month of September. And this program, we're going to talk about Bill's argument before Justice Rehnquist in the famous flag-burning cases. But it's a good time to remember Bill.
We're also going to discuss the Katrina aftermath and the disaster that has revealed the racial and class inequities in this country.
We'll also talk about what looks unfortunately like a shoo-in for our next Chief Justice. This Mr. Roberts is the way I would refer to him, and the fact that he's an acolyte of the just-passed Justice Rehnquist and what we can expect out of the Supreme Court.
Pat Robertson called for Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's assassination. Chesa Boudin, as well as Len Wineglass, the American constitutional lawyer who's been down there, and we're going to have a chance to chat with them about the scene of Venezuela and what's at stake.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Arab-Muslim South Asian advocate for the ACLU.
And this is Michael Smith, New York City lawyer and author. Bill Kunstler observed that the American police state is emerging little by little, step by step, and at some point it'll be irreversible. Just joining us in the studio as both an interviewee and a co-host, attorney Len Wineglass from New York City. Welcome, Len.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Hi, Lenny. And as I'm sure our listeners know, Lenny just won the Cuban Five case. And he's here for a lot of reasons, but one of them is we're going to talk about the 10th anniversary of Bill Kunstler's death a little bit. And Lenny was co-counsel with Bill in the infamous, famous Chicago 7 case after about so-called rioting at the Democratic Convention.
Well, it was the great case of the 60s. You know, the government indicted all the leaders of the movement, and I think it was the longest trial heretofore in the history of America. But, Michael, I wanted to note that a couple of weeks ago we were together at Bill's house with his wife and his two daughters. He had passed away 10 years almost to the date when we were there. It was Labor Day, and his daughter Sarah reminded us that every Labor Day, Bill used to burn an American flag.
In honor of his Supreme Court arguments, declaring that such burning was okay.
Yeah, two arguments. Bill said, look, the flag might mean something to one person, but to me it means racism and it means foreign oppression. And I think you got a free speech right to show what you think the flag means to you, and you can burn it. In fact, he represented in Texas versus Johnson one such defendant who did burn it and got in trouble.
I want to hear Lenny. Lenny has a lot to say about Bill, but he has one nice story he wants to mention about Bill.
During the trial of the Chicago 8, there was a practice that was followed in Judge Hoffman's courtroom where the mail would be delivered to the 8 every day. People were writing from all over the country to the 8, and they were addressing it to the chambers of Judge Hoffman. His clerk would pick up the mail and bring it in, and it would be like a camp setting where everyone was seated around a table before the jury was brought in, and the mail would be handed out and opened by the defendants through the rest of the day. Well, one day, Abby Hoffman received a large manila envelope, and he opened it in the courtroom. We were surrounded by marshals at all times. And he turned the envelope upside down, and what fell out of the envelope was a mound of marijuana that fell onto our table. And everyone just sat there. We were with law enforcement agents all around us. This was 1969. This could be a somewhat major crime. And no one would go near the mound of marijuana. Then Judge Hoffman came out and took the bench. Bill rose to the lectern and informed the judge that one of the defendants had received some vegetable material in the mail, which, based upon his experience, could pose somewhat of a legal problem. And the judge, in answering Bill, as he always did, said, "Well, Mr. Kunstler, if you have such great experience, I trust you will get rid of this vegetable material." And Bill said, "Yes, Your Honor, we'll burn it tonight." And the judge said, "Fine." So the Chicago 8, because of that dialogue in court, had the only legal marijuana in the United States, which they were under a federal court order to burn that night. And they did.
A great story, Lenny. One thing, you know, I was with Bill maybe 10 days before he died, and the only two subjects he could really talk about were they were trying to pass an amendment, which they try and do every year, to amend the Constitution to allow flag burning, I mean to prohibit flag burning. And it passes the House every year, never passes the Senate. But it always gets close. And Bill basically made the argument, and I mentioned this at the when we did the 10th anniversary of the burning of the flags, that Bill felt that any amendment to prohibit flag burning would be unconstitutional because the First Amendment really could not be amended because it was part and parcel of the original agreement to get the whole Constitution through, and therefore you couldn't actually amend the First Amendment. That was one of his arguments. And the other, he would always talk about, really, and gave me, right before he died, 23 reasons why Mumia Abu-Jamal was not guilty or should not have been convicted. So Bill was a real, real fighter till the very end of his life, as I'm sure Lenny, who worked with him closely, knew really well.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the last time I was with Bill was at a public meeting here in New York about the Mumia Abu-Jamal case, and he spoke. And as was always the custom with Bill, you get a big embrace when you meet with him. And he embraced me, and I could feel how thin and how emaciated he was. I mean, I just felt all the bones of his rib cage at that point. And it wasn't long after that that Bill did, in fact, pass. But he spoke very eloquently that day and with a lot of power and force about Mumia's case.
So we miss him a lot, but we're glad to still have the other partner of the Chicago 7 around here, Lenny Wineglass. We're about to hear from Ben Cohn, a lawyer in New Orleans, who's been representing a lot of indigent defendants in New Orleans. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
So now I know you've said that, of course, New Orleans was a constitutional and legal disaster even before Katrina, and certainly since. But why don't you tell us a little bit about, certainly since Katrina, and then go back, what's happened to really a lot of the inmates in Louisiana?
Yeah. On August 29th, there's 8,000 men in the Old Parish Prison in New Orleans. These are, for the most part, pretrial detainees, people who haven't gone to court yet, haven't been convicted of any offense. And from what we can tell, there was no plans to evacuate these individuals. There was no effort to do this before the storm. The water starts rising in New Orleans. It starts rising in the jails. They start evacuating individuals, the pretrial detainees, up the floors in the jails, getting them, moving them off the first floor.
Amazing.
That's their solution. Yeah, move.
Trying to move them up. I get varying reports from different guys about whether folks were left behind on the first floor and the second floor. They were the people who got out, the ones who we've talked to, made it to the gymnasium, which is on the top floor. And when the water reached their chest level, they were able to break through the windows.
Oh, my God. You mean this is on the top floor in the gymnasium? The water reached their level?
And they swam out.
So this is anybody below that, we don't know what happened to us.
We have no information from those guys. One a client that I've represented for 8 or 9 years, who was arrested in what appears to me to be a sweep of folks the day before the hurricane. A ton of people were arrested on public drunkenness, trespass in the day and day and a half before, and that may have been part of the New Orleans Police Department's evacuation plan or their effort to sort of lock down the city. And so a bunch of guys were arrested in these sweeps. One of them was a client of mine who I've known for 8 or 9 years, and he said that when he left, there were dozens of people who weren't leaving, who weren't able to leave.
Do you think a lot of people may have died in that prison?
I think the numbers will be, you know, more than 24, more than 36, more than 48.
So you're not going to know whether they're dead or missing or intentionally missing? They're just disappeared.
It's impossible to tell, yeah. Because, you know, folks swam out, and as, you know, they said, they were directed to swim. There were guards with guns up on the highway pass. I think folks who saw the videotape saw bunches of men sitting on the ground on a highway interpass right next to OPP where the water had not reached, and guards with guns were up there pointing at individuals to swim up and get up on that location. Many of them did, and I imagine some of them didn't. We don't know what happened, whether folks were left in and died, swam out and died, or what happened.
Or died later.
So that's immediately what happened, and then they were taken to a field out, as far as I understand, by Hunt Penitentiary. Hunt is generally the place where inmates would be classified. They weren't taken into the prison. They were just taken to a field outside the prison, a field that's enclosed by barbed wire, and they were placed in that field for 24 to 36 hours while the Department of Corrections tried to figure out where to take them.
These are all pretrial detainees?
For the large majority of these are pretrial detainees.
Yeah, one of them we heard was arrested for dealing tarot cards.
There's dozens of people who have offenses like no identification. You know, whether it's constitutional to arrest somebody or not, because they have no identification, is a separate issue. You can have a separate show on that. But these are people, you know, who arrested for, dozens and dozens of people arrested for public drunkenness on the day before the hurricane. You know, in New Orleans.
Yeah, right. They invite
drunk.
Them.
Yeah. You know, that's sort of like breathing in New Orleans.
So who's working on, I mean, I'm just trying to figure out where to go with this, because how many, I mean, where, what's going to happen to all these people? Have they been classified yet? Have they found any records? What are lawyers doing?
It took the DOC 2 weeks to find a backup tape for their computer files. Apparently, along with no evacuation plan, they had no plan to secure the kind of information. It took them 2 weeks to find that information, and they're beginning the process of trying to segregate out folks who shouldn't have been in there at all. A lot of folks, you know, generally in New Orleans would have been released on a Monday or Tuesday. You know, they would have been arrested on a Friday.
Sure, a public drunkenness charge, you're out right away,
out
right?
On Monday. A lot of folks would have just, a couple of guys who I know actually represent who were sentenced to a month of prison or a $200 fine for trespass, you know, 3 or 4 weeks before the hurricane. They didn't have $200 for a fine, so they sat in jail for a month. And they should have been released 2 weeks ago now.
Physically, where are they now?
They are spread out throughout the system.
In New Orleans, you mean?
No, throughout Louisiana. Throughout Louisiana. In a wide variety of locations, you know, jails, DOC custody. Some have been taken to Florida, it appears like. But the vast majority are either in DOC custody, meaning they're at, like, Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, or they're in local jails under the supervision of wardens. And what was particularly disturbing to me when I found out, these wardens were detaining these folks, and they had no idea why they needed to detain them. So instead of this presumption that we, you know, ordinarily have in America that, you know, you don't detain someone unless you have a reason to, they were detaining everybody just because they didn't know. And so the presumption was, keep them locked up, keep them locked up, keep them locked up.
Has there been court hearings since in the last week or two at all?
The court system, I think, fought vigorously to avoid going back to work, to avoid having to make the tough decisions about whether people should be incarcerated without a warrant, without an order, without a decision, you know, beyond the stay, beyond the length of their sentence. So the court system, and I think defense attorneys, and myself included, we failed to bring this court system back to a working model.
So we still have an utterly unconstitutional system going forward now.
We are accepting it. We're tolerating it. I think it's a black mark on all of us, and it's especially a black mark on sort of the national organizations that are watching, and they're saying, well, we don't want to get involved because this is a Louisiana problem.
For listeners that just tuned in, it's Ben Cohn, an attorney down in Louisiana, talking about how many people are in this situation, Ben?
8,000.
About 8,000 people who are kind of in limbo, I suppose in the same way there are people in limbo in Guantanamo, not knowing what they've been charged with, essentially, not being brought before a judge, just out there.
And in jails all over the state and maybe Florida. Now, when you mention national organizations, it's interesting to me, because sitting here as a lawyer, this is the kind of thing in the old days the people at my office would have said, I will go into federal court on some kind of class action and say you're holding thousands of people and set up a system.
Sure.
Now, no one is, I guess what you're saying is work like that, or what other kinds of thoughts do you have on this?
I think people are concerned, the law has gone in a bad trajectory for lawyers who want to do that, and I understand why people are more reticent now to do that than they were 20 years ago. But you get to a point where a system is no longer functioning. And I think you got to ask yourself why you'd sit back and watch that.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And, you know, the people on the ground there's a whole lot of political concerns they're trying to work out. You know, and some of them are looking to, where they're going to have an office, whether they're going to have a job, who they're going to practice in front of. And that's why, we as a sort of the broader legal community have to figure out how to get in there and push towards the constitutional system. Just say it's unacceptable not to have courts open.
How many people do you represent, Ben?
I filed, and I got a phone call sort of from a client detailing this sort of awful history, explaining to me what happened. I filed a petition on behalf of 34 different guys who were like him in his in the Rapides Parish Jail.
Which is to say that they haven't gone to court, right?
They haven't gone to court. They've served out their time. These are all guys on traffic tickets, failure to pay fines, public drunkenness, that kind of offense. The DAs are saying, well, we may have murderers here. And, I assume there's murderers, throughout society.
We got them in elected office. What are you talking about?
And they were picked up on stuff. You don't keep people on the suspension. You pick them up for a traffic violation. You don't say, well, I've got to check him out if he's a murderer. But let me ask you, what's happened to your petition?
Our petition is set for a hearing on Tuesday. The judge, the DA, said they'd have all of my guys out by Monday, and I'm waiting to see. And it's not one of those situations where I want to trust a DA and the DOC to do the right thing, but we'll be on court on Tuesday if they're not.
Yeah, and the terrible thing is as bad as they are now, when they get out, it's not going to be much better.
Well, that's clearly the case. In a lot of ways, all of these guys have been dislocated from their family. They're not they're not in touch. Their family's been taken to different parts of the country or has fled to different parts of the country. But, I hear that a lot from the Department of Corrections. Well,
No. I think they should be out. But it's just the neglect of these people, whether they're in or out, which is so terrible.
Yeah. As opposed to the inverse, which is, sort of, I think, the Barbara Bushism of America. Well, these people, are getting more now than they ever really
did. Yeah, they're in the astronom, and they're better off,
But let me ask you also, we clearly have an unconstitutional system right now, completely, utterly off the charts in terms of what this country should be about. But I think you also have some perspective on that from even before Katrina about how justice was administered in New Orleans as you saw it.
Yeah, and I think, one of the reasons we are where we are now is we didn't really hold tight to the Constitution before, and you get used to putting the Constitution in a closet on sunny days, and then you need it on a rainy day, and nobody really can find it. Nobody understands what it is. They're not used to the adversarial process. And in Louisiana, for better or for worse, public defenders overworked, underpaid, are part of the problem, I think. All of us, I'm including myself in that, and part of the problem, not part of, vigorously enforcing a constitutional regime. And so it's hard to do that when a judge secures your employment and, you're going to have to decide whether to forcefully litigate on behalf of your clients or not. And I think the defense function just isn't working there.
Well, Ben, you know, this has been a really interesting interview with you, and we'd like to actually get an update in the next week or two from you just to see what happened to both your 34 clients as well as to the situation. And maybe if we can get some of these legal institutions together to help out, we'll try and figure out something on this because it really is a pressing issue. So thanks.
Attorney Ben Cohn down in New Orleans, thanks very much.
The disaster of Hurricane Katrina revealed how deeply divided our country is in terms of treating people based on race and class. Billy Southern is with us. He's an anti-death penalty lawyer and writer from New Orleans. He also runs a nonprofit called Reprieve. We'll now join Billy Southern, who'll describe the desperate aftermath. Billy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, hi, Billy. You know, Michael Ratner and I were both downtown on 9/11 when the planes hit the towers, and people are always asking us what we were doing. Let me ask you, what were you doing when Katrina hit New Orleans?
The night before Katrina hit, the Saturday night, my wife had prevailed on me to evacuate. We decided late that night that we were going to leave town, and people just sort of deposited themselves all over the place. And I think most people left sort of optimistic that it was going to turn or that the city wouldn't be hit so badly. Mm-hmm.
What kind of cases and clients did you have then, and what's going to happen?
I represent people in their first round of appeals once they get sentenced to death. Those folks are up at Angola, Louisiana, and currently through Reprieve, we're in the process of trying to track down what happened to their families. And as I'm sure you all can imagine, the majority of my clients' families, the vast majority of my clients' families are poor people, very poor people, and minorities. And these are exactly the people who have been hardest hit by the storm, the folks who were unable to evacuate, the people who ended up in these terrible shelters, and the people who most likely aren't going to return to New Orleans because the city had so little to offer them in the first place.
Well, that's the thing that I think a lot of people have been struck by when people around the world think of New Orleans. They think of a great party place. They think of the French Quarter, fabulous restaurants, a place that you go to spend a lot of money, get drunk, and have a good time. And yet what this hurricane has revealed and the disasters revealed is actually that there is a huge underclass living way below the level of a decent standard of living.
You've known it for a while, I presume, so.
One of the things that I think is interesting about all this, one of the things you see constantly on the news right now is people discussing how in the aftermath of the storm, New Orleans looked like a third world country. That in fact, if anyone had been down in New Orleans and looking at the lives of the poor people who lived there before this storm, they would have realized that New Orleans was, in fact, a third world city well before the storm hit. And actually, this storm has done more simply to expose that reality than anything else. So to me, what I would hope is that people sort of seeing this around the country, see the real causes and consequences of poverty and begin to try to think about them differently. Because clearly these people, they didn't want to stay. Clearly these people didn't want to be treated like this. And furthermore, this whole situation, I think, exposes so much of the fraud of what the right wing has attempted to do in terms of depicting people in poverty as sort of personally responsible for their own situations, as people who are opportunistic, people who don't want to work, et cetera. When in fact, these are people who would be desperate to have gotten out of the city, desperate for better situations.
What do you think is going to happen, I mean, next? I mean, because I think, you know, we're looking at it go sort of two ways. One is this sort of renewal of the Disneyfication of New Orleans and really forgetting about the poor and just having them go out and be all over. And that seems to be, I would say, if I were guessing, that's the more likely scenario here. And really the question for me is, how do you counter that? What do you do? I mean, not only what do you do in the immediate thing to help people, I think you should talk about that, but how do we really get at what this is really, to me, exposed, you know, a major fault line, obviously, in American society that you and I and other people may have known about, but the majority of the country didn't. They're focusing, of course, the sort of, you know, who's responsible for leaving the people in the Superdome, which, you know, they're going to the immediate thing, and the federal government is pouring supposedly stuff in there now. And so people are going to be looking at only the immediate question rather than, I think, I'm afraid, they won't be looking at what you're referring to as the longer, you know, deeper reasons for why we have a New Orleans like this at all.
But people are also focusing on New Orleans like they're focusing on, you know, the blame and who let this happen. They're also just focusing on New Orleans. I mean, there are places in Mississippi where FEMA hasn't even gotten to yet. I heard yesterday that it's like a joke.
When are you planning to go back, Bill?
I went back for the first time last Sunday to assess the damage at my house, to try to locate my car, to try to take care of some other things while I was down there. And that was my first trip back, and it was amazing to see the city essentially occupied by, you know, the United States government, basically military people everywhere and absolutely no citizens. And I'm not sure what I think about that in the end, but it definitely does complete the sort of third world atmosphere in New Orleans. You know, American military occupation definitely puts New Orleans in the pantheon of great third world cities. So I plan on returning back as soon as possible. It's my understanding that the mayor is going to let people come back in the area that I live in as soon as next week. But I think one of the things that Dahlia just mentioned about, you know, what about the rest of the country, what about Mississippi, I think one of the other things that this raises is, you know, how would other urban poor areas across the country have responded to something like this? You know, that, you know, one of the issues I think that this highlights is poverty. And it highlights specifically poverty in New Orleans. But, you know, if this storm, something like this had hit New York, you know, how many people in the Bronx would have been abandoned? Or if this hit Washington, D.C., how many people there would have been abandoned? Because of the very same issues that sort of led to the real tragedy, which was all these people left behind. So I think that this, you know, I think we do need to see this as a national issue, first of all. And then I think that, you know, to the extent that there is an American progressive community, I think that we need to force the debate to be about these poverty issues, about the long-term poverty issues and the role that the government should have played in people's lives and what we can do to change that, rather than merely focusing on the sort of surface issues about, you know, why were these people left in the Superdome. Of course, we need to figure that out, but I think that the long-term notion that the left and the progressive community needs to push for is, you know, why were these people left this way in the first place?
Right. No, I think that's really important, and I agree with you. And I think the question is whether this will really be, as some people have said, you know, the final bursting point for this administration in really 25 or more years in this country of saying government isn't going to help you. You're out on your own. Struggle yourself. And this is the result, whether it's in New Orleans or the Bronx.
Now, I can also tell you, my office is right across the street from Ground Zero. There's absolutely nothing been built in Ground Zero in 4 years. It's still an empty hole. And unless there's going to be a movement in this country, the equivalent to, say, what happened during the New Deal, and our resources are totally reorganized, New Orleans is going to be an empty hole.
No, but there are also reasons why they're keeping Ground Zero empty. I mean, that's a little bit different.
Well,
from
they
New
can't
Orleans.
Make a profit out of building something there because they've got no tenants that want to move in there.
I think the real thing you're saying, though, about New Orleans is, you know, they came out with a report that the Bronx is the poorest county in the United States. We live in Manhattan. I have friends who work Coalition for the Homeless, other places. People in New York don't even realize that we have the poorest single county in the United States. And in Manhattan itself, we have the poorest single census tract at 119th Street. So New Orleans is there with incredible poverty, but so is it right here. And I think it's time for the country to wake up.
Billy, thank you very much for being on the program. We want you to keep in touch with us when you get your office back in shape and you start litigating again. We'd like to talk to you some more.
Will do.
Take it easy.
Okay, bye-bye.
You want more information? Check our website. Heidi, what's that website?
Lawanddisorder.org.
I can't say that I would be moved to bring the flag down for Rehnquist.
The kind of outpouring of heartfelt sentiment about the loss of Rehnquist really, truly was nauseating.
Yeah.
I mean, Rehnquist grew up in the neighborhood where I grew up, in Milwaukee. And I remember one of the first things I ever heard about him is that he had a negative reciprocal covenant in the deed to his house, which said he couldn't sell it to a Jew. When he graduated Sherwood High School years ago, people remembered, and they had the something like the 50th anniversary of graduation from that high school. Dozens of graduates and current students came out, and they tried to honor Rehnquist at the high school, and they came out and picketed him.
One thing, of course, you know, that comes to mind now about Rehnquist, I think that's really important and was suggested by Bruce Shapiro, who writes for The Nation. He said when he looked at New Orleans, what he thought about really was that that was a fitting, particularly the people in the Superdome or in the convention center, he thought about that that is basically Rehnquist's legacy. That Rehnquist, if people may recall, when he was clerking at the Supreme Court, wrote a memo called A Random Thought on the Segregation Cases. And that was the question he was facing as a clerk of whether they should overrule a case called Plessy v. Ferguson, which allowed for separate but so-called equal education of African Americans. And Rehnquist's opinion was, as he quoted him, as he says in the memo, quote, "I realize that this is an unpopular and unhumanitarian position for which I've been excoriated by liberal colleagues. But I think Plessy v. Ferguson was right and should be reaffirmed."
Yeah, you know, that was the decision back in the 1890s that said it's legal under our Constitution to pass laws that keep blacks in one place and whites in another.
And when you look at the people in New Orleans, which has the worst single education system in the United States, that's the legacy of Rehnquist and really the legacy of Plessy v. Ferguson.
You bet.
So I think we start from Rehnquist from there, and then, of course, we go forward to Roberts, which Roberts considers himself an acolyte of Rehnquist.
He worked for Rehnquist.
Right, yeah. He worked for him. And so you have to ask yourselves, what is this country creating except essentially two really utterly unequal societies?
Yeah, and the irony was that Rehnquist and guys like him, you know, Young American for Freedoms and these other student types in the late 50s and the early 60s, those people were like a minority on campus. Dahlia, you weren't on campus then, but Michael and I were. The movement was growing. We had Students for a Democratic Society. We wanted to talk about economic democracy. And there was a little fringe group of right-wing nuts that we didn't pay much attention to. And the irony is that these guys got themselves elected and got themselves the head of the Supreme Court, and they still are.
So how do you think Roberts is going to measure up next to him?
A disaster.
I think he's shorter.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Just terrible. I think he's just a fraud out there.
What? How many? 2 years on the court?
2 years on the court.
Yeah.
And they won't give us his opinions when he was working with the Solicitor General. So we go back to his opinions 25 years ago, which are pretty retrograde on the issues we care about, everything from affirmative action to women. And the one experience I've had, of course, as a lawyer representing Guantanamo detainees, is sitting on a key constitutional issue and legal issue, the question of application of Geneva Conventions to the Guantanamo people, sitting on that case, deciding that case, while he was being offered the Supreme Court judgeship.
Yeah, didn't he meet with President Bush? It was Hamdan.
And he met with Gonzalez as well. Alberto Gonzalez, architect of the policy we were challenging, meets with him a week before the argument in that case, and he never disqualifies himself, never notifies the attorneys that we work with who are representing the Guantanamo detainees, at all, goes and makes an essentially on a key issue a 2-1 decision about the fact that Geneva doesn't have any rights, that doesn't afford any rights to the people in Guantanamo.
He's applying for a job with the president when the president has a case in front of him. He gives the president a favorable decision and then he gets the job.
One of the rare cases where the president can actually be sued in the United States because the president actually signed the order committing Hamdan to Guantanamo.
And then now he's going to be seeing that case again.
Well, he won't be able to sit on it again. But the fact is that alone, that ethical lapse or violation really of a statute, and I consider a lapse, it's really a serious violation, should disqualify this guy from the court altogether.
Yeah.
And there's some attention being paid. But, you know, when I sit there and I watch Congress look at these guys, and I even hear some hard questions occasionally, it reminds me of the Roman Senate, you know, after there's no longer a republic. There's essentially imperialist country, imperialist Rome, and they're just fawning over each other and, you know, loving this guy up and occasionally giving him a few hard questions. But it seems to have nothing to do with what's the reality on the ground, whether in New Orleans or in the Bronx, which was recently found to be the poorest single county in the United States.
Yeah,
right here. Dahlia, you were going to give us some yes.
Yeah, you look at his – he has a long political affiliation with the Bush family. He's contributed a good sum of money to the 2000 Bush-Cheney election campaign. He was a member of Lawyers for Bush-Cheney – He campaigned for Bush Quail in 88, another great team. And he's a member of D.C. Lawyers for Bush Quail. In 1988, he was the on the executive committee. Like, this guy is in line with Bush 1 and Bush 2.
No, it's more the same, and it's unfortunate because I actually think we may be seeing soon a sea change in the United States in terms of activist politics, particularly across a broad level, and yet we're sticking a guy like this into a court. It's going to remind me of the 30s when they tried to put the New Deal in and you had some really Neanderthals on the court trying to hold back progress, and that's what I'm afraid we're going to see here.
Rehnquist has been there since what? Since Nixon.
Nixon, so it's over
30 years. So this guy's younger than Rehnquist
was. Listeners out there, we're in deep trouble on this court.
And get to know him because he's going to be with
us. This means take to the streets, not to the courts.
I was going
to
say, get yourself organized and get in the streets because in the end, they do count the votes.
Yeah, beyond being a flip comment, what do you think that really means for lawsuits? Are we going to be holding, for the next, four decades, are we going to be holding cases back because we want to avoid a bad decision?
Yeah, we don't. The center never has. Yeah. I still use sometimes a different philosophy. But we've heard this for 20 years, actually, when Rehnquist took the court, when they got a majority. We still won the Guantanamo cases in the court. And you still use it as a forum. You just don't win on your own in that forum. And it shows the bankruptcy of the system if you lose.
You establish bad law if you lose.
Yeah, but that's there anyway because they're doing those policies. And so you got to take people to the streets.
We're all lawyers, we do some good. But we all know that lawyers are kind of an ancillary part of the movement. And the movement is the movement. And that's where change gets made. And sometimes we can do it in the courts. But our listeners, get out in the streets.
Go to Washington.
We want to welcome to Law and Disorder old friend and comrade Chesa Boudin, just back from Venezuela. Chesa was down there for over a year. He was doing some political research and analysis in between school gigs. Out of that came three books. I want to welcome you to the show, Chesa.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I want to mention the books now, and I'm going to mention them again, so get a pencil. The first one is the book he actually translated. Marta Heinecker interviewed Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. The book's called Understanding the Venezuelan Revolution. That book, I think, is out now, Monthly Review Press. The other book is in the pipeline. Chesa wrote this book along with two other Venezuelans, Gabriel Gonzalez and Wilma Rumbos. This book is called The Venezuelan Revolution, 100 Questions, 100 Answers. Chesa is the co-author to that. And the third book that's also in the pipeline, Letters from Young Activists, and Chesa edited that book. You've been quite busy lately, Chesa. Congratulations. And with us is Len Weinglass, New York City constitutional lawyer. Len has been down in Venezuela twice, just recently for the World Youth Festival. And back in December, Chesa was actually one of the translators at the Artists and Intellectuals Conference down in Caracas. And Len attended that. So they were together then and know each other even apart from that. We wanted to have Len on the show to act, I guess, both as an interviewer and an interviewee. Welcome to the show, Len Weinglass.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Chesa, 3 weeks ago, I'm sure you're aware of this, Pat Robertson, one of the big supporters of Bush, kind of an unofficial member of the government, really, came out and said that, in his opinion, President Hugo Chavez, the democratically elected president of Venezuela, should be assassinated. You got to wonder. What's the Chavez government doing down there? It must be doing something right.
Yeah, well, I think there's two immediate points that come to mind. One is that Robertson is actually the only person connected to the administration that's being totally honest. So I think we got to give him credit for that. Certainly lots of people in Washington have been talking about it, and he's the only one who's come out and admitted it. And President Chavez has been saying for months that there's plans coming out of Washington to assassinate him, and everybody's been denying it. And now we have somebody connected to the Bush administration saying, actually, we're thinking about it. So I think that's one point to keep in mind. In terms of why they would want to assassinate a democratically elected president of a neighboring country with whom we've had very good relations historically, I think the key point is that Chavez, unlike most other Latin American governments and most previous Venezuelan governments, is determined to have independent foreign policy, a policy that's not determined by the Washington Consensus, as it's called. It's something that, as much as Cuba has done for the last 30 or 40 years, Venezuela has become a model, an alternative model for government and for social policy throughout Latin America and indeed the world. And I think that that alternative is something that is very scary for the Washington Consensus.
Yes, Chase, I wanted to ask you a question that concerned a lot of us who were temporarily in Venezuela, unlike yourself. And that is the question of, could you describe for the listeners the nature of the news media in Venezuela today in the interaction of the news media with the government?
It's an important point, Lenny, so thanks for bringing that up. I think it's very difficult to describe. It's the kind of thing that you really need to see to believe. Venezuelans talk about a media war between the government and the private media, and I think that's probably the best way to describe it. The private media is largely owned by the economic elite, very closely tied to the traditional political elite in Venezuela, and they have been really committed to getting Chavez out of power by any means possible. When Chavez was elected, the traditional political parties, the AD party and the COPEI party, pretty much imploded. And the private media in Venezuela has filled that void. And so what you'll see very commonly is, for example, a headline in which a new law being debated by Congress that Chavez is supporting is claimed to be ending 100 years of liberty, even though the country's only had 40 years of democracy. Or you'll see a picture of Chavez with a bullseye on his forehead. And then, of course, in the United States, if you read the U.S. media about what's going on in Venezuela, you'll hear that there's censorship and that there's a crackdown on the media. What there is a government campaign to develop alternative media, to give out radio transmitters to poor neighborhoods, to the barrios around Caracas, to have state-run TV. And, of course, most recently, and I think most excitingly, Telesur, which is a regional network that the Venezuelan government initiated and which has been supported by the Uruguayan government, the Argentine government, the Cuban government, and the Brazilian government, and which is going to be sort of a counterpart to Al Jazeera, but in Latin America.
As a follow-up to that, with the media being so critical of the government, and by most estimates approximately 30% of the population being in opposition to the government, could you tell us how the government is able to function and whether it can function effectively with a third of the country in opposition and the private media so critical of it?
Well, it's certainly a significant factor in day-to-day government operations in Venezuela. But I want to point out, as you said, there's roughly a third of the country that's in opposition. But that means that two-thirds, more than two-thirds really, the latest polls say over 70%, support the government. And that's huge. I think there's very few democratically elected leaders who 4 or 5 years into their term have that kind of popular support. So I think that's an important half-full, half-empty sort of counterpoint to understand what's going on there. But it's also certainly true that the media in particular, and even the civil service corps that was loyal to the previous political parties that were in power prior to Chavez, have done everything they can to undermine Chavez's political program, and it's really slowed him down. And it's, I think, exacerbated what is already a pretty bureaucratic and top-heavy government.
Venezuela is a much larger country than most Americans realize.
Now, Lenny, you were there a couple of times. What was your reason for going? What did you think about it?
Well, as Mike Smith suggests, I was there at two conferences, each time spending 3, 4, 5 days. I never left the city of Caracas, which is a huge city, I think 5.5 million
That's correct.
People. My impressions were just gathered from first a convention setting in the urban center of Caracas. We found that there was a fair amount of military presence. I think there was an effort made to protect the people who were there at the conference. There was a lot of concern about security. There were obviously people who were in opposition to Chavez who wanted to reach those who came to the conference to propagandize them. And we certainly had people tell us that it's a dangerous city, that there's a lot of crime, that you can't go into the parks. All those sorts of things were told to us by people who were trying to reach those who were there at the conference in order to give them a negative impression of the Chavez government. So we did have that. We did see the media, and that's why I addressed the question to Chase about that, because the media was very hostile to the conference, belittling the conference, belittling the people who came to the conference, even though they were some of the leading intellectuals in the world. And so you could tell that you were in a cauldron. I think probably, and Chase could correct me on this, the capital city of Caracas probably houses much of the opposition.
Yes.
And that if you get out into the country, the support is much greater and the opposition is much weaker. So it's hard to answer your question, it's hard to gather and gain an accurate impression of what's happening in the country, being there just a few days at a conference in a relatively hostile environment.
Now, one of the reasons you were there, Lenny, of course, I think, was for the Cuban Five case. Is that right?
Yes.
And one thing we haven't really talked about, I think, is, you know, is to what extent that's a factor. Venezuela, not just the Cuban Five, but the Venezuela's relationship with Cuba, what it does about oil with Cuba, what it even suggested to do with oil about the United States. But anyway, I don't know if Chase has any thoughts about that, or Lenny does.
Yeah, sure. I'll jump in, and then Lenny, okay, if you want to add. One of the things that you see in just about any article in the English language media that talks about Venezuela is this reference to how good friends Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro are. And it's really the way that it's sort of the defining characteristic in the U.S. media of Hugo Chavez, his alliance with Cuba. And much is made, as you mentioned, of the treaty between Cuba and Venezuela that provides Cuba with preferential buying terms on Venezuelan oil. What's often, almost always, in fact, left out of those articles is the fact that Venezuela provides very similar preferential buying terms to all of the Caribbean countries that have agreed to accept the terms, and to most of Central America as well. Venezuela, as I mentioned earlier, has been making an effort to diversify its markets beyond just the United States. And one of the ways it's done that is to provide preferential terms for its oil to its neighbors.
I think it supplies 16% of U.S. oil, so it's trying to diversify that a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, it's 16% of U.S. imports.
U.S. imports, yeah. I'm sorry.
Hey, they light up the east coast of the United States, and they got 1,400 gas stations.
Sitco. 14,000, actually.
14,000. Yeah. So try to buy your gas at Sitco.
Yeah, they provide 150,000 American jobs through the Sitco gas stations.
For those of you who just tuned in to Law and Disorder, let me introduce to you our two guests. Chase Aboudin, just back from Venezuela on his way to back to school in England, and Len Wineglass. Len was the successful appellate attorney for the great case of the Cuban Five. Chase, I wanted to ask you this. When the United States plotted to overthrow the democratically elected socialist government of Chile under Salvador Allende, the main device they used was the Chilean middle class. With the large middle class in Caracas, my fear is the same, that those are the people that are getting educated and motivated and mobilized to use as the shock troops against Chavez. What was it like down there, and what did you see? What kind of activity are those people involved in?
It's an important point. The middle class is probably going to be the key to the failure or the success of what they call the Bolivarian Revolution. That's President Chavez's political movement. I think it's too early to say exactly what's going to happen. In the initial stages, when Chavez was first elected president back in 1998-99, he had a good amount of support from the middle classes. And I think because so much of his energy and so much social policy has been focused on the poorest of Venezuelans, when Chavez was elected, about 85% of the country lived in poverty. 67% of the country lived on less than $2 a day. And the Chavez administration has prioritized meeting those citizens' needs. And so I think for many members of the middle class, taxi drivers, academics, what they've experienced is the kind of rapid rising of the lower class, and they haven't felt that many tangible benefits themselves. So I think many members of the middle class are scared, are uncomfortable with the political process right now, and it's something that the Chavez government is very much aware of and trying to address. But it's yet to be determined what will really happen with the middle class.
Chase, I thought one point you made that was really interesting to me. I mean, you know, we've seen how the U.S. has, you know, overthrown everything. I mean, you were in Chile, you saw it in 73, of course. That happened, and I've seen it unfold in Nicaragua, where they put people, as you talked about, on the Honduras border to go into Nicaragua's the Contras. And it worried me a lot to hear you talk about the border with Colombia. And Is there any evidence so far that the U.S. is actually working with any kind of paramilitaries out of Colombia that go into Venezuela, or beginning that sort of, you want to call it conference or whatever, in Colombia?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, obviously, I don't have access to any kind of classified intelligence. So what I know is what anybody can find in news reports. And I'll refer your listeners to two different issues, one, both of which can be found with simple searches on the internet. There was a recent event in Colombia where U.S. Army soldiers who were in Colombia as part of what they call Plan Colombia, which is the United States essentially military aid package for the Colombian government, and several military officers, U.S. military officers, who were stationed in Colombia under the guise of Plan Colombia, were found plotting to sell tens of thousands of rounds of ammunition to paramilitary groups. So I think that's an example. It's not clear what those bullets were intended for. It's not clear if those soldiers were acting on orders or if they were simply trying to make a little cash on the side.
The thing is, this has all the hallmarks is the problem. If you look at Nicaragua, it was all murky in the beginning.
Yep.
You know, it had all the things. It had this middle class stuff. It had the attempted coup stuff. It had all
the media.
The media, the whole business of the Cuba connection, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so it gets you very – it gets you very nervous.
Well, I'll tell you, I think you're right on. There's a really worthwhile interview that I encourage all of you to take a look at. It's a young journalist, a Canadian journalist named Jonah Gindin, did an interview with a man named Philip Agee, who many of you may have heard of, who's a former member of the CIA, who wrote a book sort of revealing the way that the CIA operates in Latin America and has been living in Cuba in exile since then pretty much for most of his life. But quite recently, Jonah did an interview, Jonah Gindin, who writes for Venezuela Analysis, which is an online news, English-language news source dedicated to Venezuela. And Jonah did an interview with Philip Agee in which Philip talks about exactly that issue and the extent to which the United States is using its intervention in Nicaragua as a model for what it's trying to do in Venezuela today. And I think the number of similarities are really overwhelming. It's worth reading because he really lays it out in quite in extreme detail. But one of the examples I give you is it's primarily a political electoral intervention, which means massive amounts of funding are going to the Venezuelan opposition, as they did in Nicaragua. So, for example, in today or yesterday's news, the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a non-governmental institution that's entirely funded and controlled by U.S. Congress, announced that it was giving over $100,000 to a group that has actively participated in trying to overthrow the Chavez regime. Both its leaders participated in the 2002 coup, and the group itself was dedicated to trying to get him out of office during the 2004 referendum.
You know, amazing. In some way, there should be no surprises. I mean, if you look at Nicaragua, what's one thing? But you look at Venezuela, it's a much bigger issue. I mean, Nicaragua, they made it up to a large extent. I mean, they didn't like the fact that it was going in a progressive way, but Venezuela has the oil, and I think that just heightens what you're saying, Chase.
Absolutely. The stakes are very high in Venezuela.
Get your pencils, listeners. We're going to say goodbye to Chase and thank him. But before I do that, let me just mention the three books that he's been responsible for getting out. The first is Understanding the Venezuelan Revolution, Hugo Chavez Talks to Martha Heinecker. Chase was the translator of that book. It's out Monthly Review Press. You can go get it now. There's another book in the pipeline, be out any minute now, that Chase co-wrote. It's called The Venezuelan Revolution, 100 Questions, 100 Answers. And the third, which is also in the pipeline, is Letters from Young Activists. And Chase Boudin was the editor of that book. Chase Boudin, thank you very much. It's terrific to have you on the show and to appreciate the kind of work you've been doing. And good luck to you.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.